Max's family fell into the latter category. Walter checked on them occasionally, as inconspicuously as he could. One afternoon, when he visited, someone else opened the door. When Max heard the news, his body felt like it was being screwed up into a ball, like a page littered with mistakes, like garbage. Yet each day he managed to unravel and straighten himself, disgusted and thankful. Wrecked, but somehow not torn into pieces. Halfway through 1939, just over 6 months into the period of hiding, they decided that a new course of action needed to be taken. They examined the piece of paper Max was handed upon his desertion. That's right, his desertion, not only his escape. That was how he viewed it, amid the grotesquerie of his relief. We already know what was written on that piece of paper. One name, one address. Hans Hubermann, Himmel Street 33, Malking. "It's getting worse," Walter told Max. "Any time now they could find us out." There was much hunching in the dark. "We don't know what might happen. I might get caught. You might need to find that place. I'm too scared to ask anyone for help here. They might put me in." There was only one solution. "I'll go down there and find this man. If he's turned into a Nazi, which is very likely, I'll just turn around. At least we know then. Richtig?" Max gave him every last pfennig to make the trip, and a few days later, when Walter returned, they embraced before he held his breath. "And?" Walter nodded. "He's good. He still plays that accordion your mother told you about, your father's. He's not a member of the party. He gave me money." At this stage, Hans Hubermann was only a list. "He's fairly poor, he's married, and there's a kid." This sparked Max's attention even further. "How old?" 10. "You can't have everything." "Yes. Kids have big mouths. We are lucky as it is." They sat in silence a while. It was Max who disturbed it. "He must already hate me, huh?"
"I don't think so. He gave me the money, didn't he? He said a promise is a promise."
A week later, a letter came. Hans notified Walter Kugler that he would try to send things to help whenever he could. There was a one-page map of Malking and Greater Munich, as well as a direct route from Passing, the more reliable train station, to his front door. In his letter, the last words were obvious. "Be careful." Midway through May 1940, Mein Kampf arrived, with a key taped to the inside cover. The man's a genius, Max decided, but there was still a shudder when he thought about traveling to Munich. Clearly he wished, along with the other parties involved, that the journey would not have to be made at all. You don't always get what you wish for, especially in Nazi Germany. Again, time passed. The war expanded. Max remained hidden from the world in another empty room, until the inevitable. Walter was notified that he was being sent to Poland to continue the assertion of Germany's authority over both the Poles and Jews alike. One was not much better than the other. The time had come. Max made his way to Munich and Malking, and now he sat in a stranger's kitchen, asking for the help he craved and suffering the condemnation he felt he deserved. Hans Hubermann shook his hand and introduced himself. He made him some coffee in the dark. The girl had been gone quite a while, but now some more footsteps had approached a rival. The wild card. In the darkness, all three of them were completely isolated. They all stared. Only the woman spoke. The Wrath of Rosa. Liesel had drifted back to sleep when the unmistakable voice of Rosa Hubermann entered the kitchen. It shocked her awake.
"Was ist los?"
Curiosity got the better of her then, as she imagined a tirade thrown down from the Wrath of Rosa. There was definite movement and the shuffle of a chair. After 10 minutes of excruciating discipline, Liesl made her way to the corridor, and what she saw truly amazed her, because Rosa Huberman was at Max Vandenberg's shoulder, watching him gulp down her infamous pea soup. Candlelight was standing at the table. It did not waver. Mama was grave. Her plump figure glowed with worry. Somehow, though, there was also a look of triumph on her face. And it was not the triumph of having saved another human being from persecution. It was something more along the lines of, "See? At least he's not complaining." She looked from the soup to the Jew to the soup. When she spoke again, she asked only if he wanted more. Max declined, preferring instead to rush to the sink and vomit. His back convulsed and his arms were well spread. His fingers gripped the metal. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph," Rosa muttered. "Another one." Turning around, Max apologized. His words were slippery and small, quelled by the acid. "I'm sorry. I think I ate too much. My stomach, you know, it's been so long since..." "I don't think it can handle such..." "Move," Rosa ordered him. She started cleaning up. She found the young man at the kitchen, utterly morose. Hans was sitting opposite, hands carved the sheet of wood. Lee from the hallway could see the worn face of the stranger. Behind it, the worried diction spilled like a muckens onto Mama. She looked both her foster parents. Who were people? Liesl's lecture. Exactly what kind of people Hans and Rosa Huberman were was not the easiest problem to solve. Kind people? Ridiculously ignorant people? People of questionable sanity? What was easier to define was their predicament. The situation of Hans and Rosa Huberman. Very sticky indeed. In fact, frightfully sticky. When a Jew shows up at your place of residence in the early hours of morning, in the very birthplace of Nazism, you're likely to experience extreme levels of discomfort. Anxiety, disbelief, paranoia, each plays its part, and each leads to a sneaking suspicion that a less than heavenly consequence awaits. The fear is shiny, ruthless in the eyes. The surprising point to make is that despite this iridescent fear glowing as it did in the dark, they somehow resisted the urge for hysteria. Mama ordered Liesl away. "Bet, sau Mensch." The voice calm but firm. Highly unusual. Papa came in a few minutes later and lifted the covers on the vacant bed. "Alles gut, Liesl? Is everything good?"
"Yes, Papa."
"As you can see, we have a visitor." She could only just make out the shape of Hans Huberman's tallness in the dark. "He'll sleep in here tonight."
"Yes, Papa."
A few minutes later, Max Vandenberg was in the room, noiseless and opaque. The man did not breathe. He did not move. Yet somehow he traveled from the doorway to the bed and was under the covers. "Everything good?" It was Papa again, talking this time to Max. The reply floated from his mouth, then molded itself like a stain to the ceiling. Such was his feeling of shame.
"Yes, thank you."
He said it again, when Papa made his way over to his customary position in the chair next to Liesl's bed. "Thank you." Another hour passed before Liesl fell asleep. She slept hard and long. A hand woke her just after 8:30 the next morning. The voice at the end of it informed her that she would not be attending school that day. Apparently, she was sick. When she awoke completely, she watched the stranger in the bed opposite. The blanket showed only a nest of lopsided hair at the top, and there was not a sound, as if he'd somehow trained himself even to sleep more quietly. With great care, she walked the length of him, following Papa to the hall. For the first time ever, the kitchen and Mama were dormant. It was a kind of bemused, inaugural silence. To Liesl's relief, It lasted only a few minutes. There was food and the sound of eating. Mama announced the day's priority. She sat at the table and said, "Now, listen, Liesl. Papa's going to tell you something today." This was serious. She didn't even say Zalmensch. It was a personal feat of abstinence. "He'll talk to you, and you have to listen. Is that clear?" The girl was still swallowing. "Is that clear, Zalmensch?" That was better. The girl nodded. When she re-entered the bedroom to fetch her clothes, the body in the opposite bed had turned and curled up. It was no longer a straight log, but a kind of Z-shape, reaching diagonally from corner to corner, zigzagging the bed. She could see his face now, in the tired light. His mouth was open, and his skin was the color of eggshells. Whiskers coated his jaw and chin, and his ears were hard and flat. He had a small but misshapen nose. "Liesl!" She turned. "Move it!" She moved, to the washroom. Once changed and in the hallway, she realized she would not be traveling far. Papa was standing in front of the door to the basement. He smiled very faintly, lit the lamp, and led her down. Among the mounds of drop sheets and the smell of paint, Papa told her to make herself comfortable. Ignited on the walls were the painted words learned in the past. "I need to tell you some things." Liesl sat on top of a meter-tall heap of drop sheets, Papa on a 15-liter paint can. For a few minutes, he searched for the words. When they came, he stood to deliver them. He rubbed his eyes. "Liesl," he said quietly, "I was never sure if any of this would happen, so I never told you. About me, about the men upstairs." He walked from one end of the basement to the other, the lamplight magnifying his shadow. It turned him into a giant on the wall, walking back and forth. When he stopped pacing, his shadow loomed behind him, watching. Someone was always watching. "You know my accordion?" he said. And there the story began. He explained World War I and Erich Vandenberg, and then the visit to the fallen soldier's wife. "The boy who came into the room that day is the man upstairs. Verstehst? Understand?" The book thief sat and listened to Hans Hubermann's story. It lasted a good hour, until the moment of truth, which involved a very obvious and necessary lecture. "Liesl, you must listen." Papa made her stand up and held her hand. They faced the wall. Dark shapes and the practice of words. Firmly, he held her fingers. "Remember the Führer's birthday? When we walked home from the fire that night? Remember what you promised me?" The girl concurred. To the wall she said, "That I would keep a secret." "That's right." Between the hand-holding shadows, the painted words were scattered about, perched on their shoulders, resting on their heads, and hanging from their arms. "Liesl, if you tell anyone about the men up there, we will all be in big trouble." He walked the fine line of scaring her into oblivion and soothing her enough to keep her calm. He fed her the sentences and watched with his metallic eyes. Desperation and placidity. "At the very least, Mama and I will be taken away." Hans was clearly worried that he was on the verge of frightening her too much, but he calculated the risk, preferring to err on the side of too much fear rather than not enough. The girl's compliance had to be an absolute, immutable fact. Toward the end, Hans Hubermann looked at Liesl Memminger and made certain she was focused. He gave her a list of consequences. "If you tell anyone about that man, her teacher, Rudy, it didn't matter whom. What mattered was that all were punishable." "For starters," he said, "I will take each and every one of your books, and I will burn them." It was callous. "I throw them in the stove or the fireplace." He was certainly acting like a tyrant, but it was necessary. Understand? The shock made a hole in her, very neat, very precise. Tears welled.
Yes, Papa.
Next. He had to remain hard, and he needed to strain for it. They'll take you away from me. Do you want that? She was crying now in earnest.
Nine.
Good. His grip on her hand tightened. They'll drag that man up there away, and maybe Mama and me too, and we will never, ever come back. And that did it. The girl began to sob so uncontrollably that Papa was dying to pull her into him and hug her tight. He didn't. Instead, he squatted down and watched her directly in the eyes. He unleashed his quietest words so far. Verstehst du mich? Do you understand me? The girl nodded. She cried. And now, defeated, broken, her Papa held her in the painted air and the kerosene light.
I understand, Papa. I do.
Her voice was muffled against his body, and they stayed like that for a few minutes, Liesel with squashed breath, and Papa rubbing her back. Upstairs, when they returned, they found Mama sitting in the kitchen alone and pensive. When she saw them, she stood and beckoned Liesel to come over, noticing the dried-up tears that streaked her. She brought the girl into her and heaped a typically rugged embrace around her body. Alles gut, Sommage? She didn't need an answer. Everything was good, but it was awful, too. The Sleeper. Max Vandenberg slept for 3 days. In certain excerpts of that sleep, Liesel watched him. You might say that by the third day it became an obsession, to check on him, to see if he was still breathing. She could now interpret his signs of life, from the movement of his lips, his gathering beard, and the twigs of hair that moved ever so slightly when his head twitched in the dream state. Often, when she stood over him, there was the mortifying thought that he had just woken up, his eyes splitting open to view her, to watch her watching. The idea of being caught out plagued and enthused her at the same time. She dreaded it. She invited it. Only when Mama called out to her could she drag herself away, simultaneously soothed and disappointed that she might not be there when he woke. Sometimes, close to the end of the marathon of sleep, he spoke. There was a recital of murmured names, a checklist. Isaac, Aunt Ruth, Sarah, Mama, Walter, Hitler. Family, friend, enemy. They were all under the covers with him, and at one point he appeared to be struggling with himself. Nein, he whispered. It was repeated 7 times. No. Liesel, in the act of watching, was already noticing the similarities between this stranger and herself. They both arrived in a state of agitation on Himmel Street. They both nightmared. When the time came, he awoke with a nasty thrill of disorientation. His mouth opened a moment after his eyes, and he sat up, right-angled.
Aye!
A patch of voice escaped his mouth. When he saw the upside-down face of a girl above him, there was the fretful moment of unfamiliarity and the grasp for a recollection, to decode exactly where and when he was currently sitting. After a few seconds, he managed to scratch his head, the rustle of kindling, and he looked at her. His movements were fragmented, and now that they were open, his eyes were swampy and brown, thick and heavy. As a reflex action, Liesel backed away. She was too slow. The stranger reached out, his bed-warmed hand taking her by the forearm.
Please.
His voice also held on, as if possessing fingernails. He pressed it into her flesh.
Papa!
Loud.
Please.
Soft. It was late afternoon, grey and gleaming, but it was only dirty coloured light that was permitted entrance into the room. It was all the fabric of the curtains allowed. If you're optimistic, think of it as bronze. When Papa came in, he first stood in the doorway and witnessed Max Vandenberg's gripping fingers and his desperate face. Both held onto Liesel's arm. "I see you two have met," he said. Max's fingers started cooling. The Swapping of Nightmares. Max Vandenberg promised that he would never sleep in Liesel's room again. What was he thinking that first night? The very idea of it mortified him. He rationalized that he was so bewildered upon his arrival that he allowed such a thing. The basement was the only place for him, as far as he was concerned. Forget the cold and the loneliness. He was a Jew, and if there was one place he was destined to exist, it was a basement or any other such hidden venue of survival. "I'm sorry," he confessed to Hans and Rosa on the basement steps. "From now on, I will stay down here. You will not hear from me. I will not make a sound." Hans and Rosa, both steeped in the despair of the predicament, made no argument, not even in regard to the cold. They heaved blankets down and topped up the kerosene lamp. Rosa admitted that there could not be much food, to which Max fervently asked her to bring only scraps, and only when they were not wanted by anyone else. "Na, na," Rosa assured him, "you will be fed as best I can." They also took the mattress down from the spare bed in Liesel's room, replacing it with drop sheets, an excellent trade. Downstairs, Hans and Max placed the mattress beneath the steps and built a wall of drop sheets at the side. The sheets were high enough to cover the whole triangular entrance, and if nothing else, they were easily moved if Max was in dire need of extra air. Papa apologized. "It's quite pathetic, I realize that." "Better than nothing," Max assured him. "Better than I deserve. Thank you." With some well-positioned paint cans, Hans actually conceded that it did simply look like a collection of junk gathered sloppily in the corner, out of the way. The one problem was that a person needed only to shift a few cans and remove a drop sheet or two to smell out the Jew. "Let's just hope it's good enough," he said. "It has to be." Max crawled in. Again he said it. "Thank you." "Thank you." For Max Vandenberg, those were the two most pitiful words he could possibly say, rivaled only by "I'm sorry." There was a constant urge to speak both expressions, spurred on by the affliction of guilt. How many times in those first few hours of awakeness did he feel like walking out of that basement and leaving the house altogether? It must have been hundreds. Each time, though, it was only a twinge, which made it even worse. He wanted to walk out. Lord, how he wanted to. Or at least, he wanted to want to. But he knew he wouldn't. It was much the same as the way he left his family in Stuttgart, under a veil of fabricated loyalty. To live. Living was living. The price was guilt and shame. For his first few days in the basement, Liesel had nothing to do with him. She denied his existence, his rustling hair, his cold, slippery fingers, his tortured presence. Mama and Papa. There was such gravity between them, and a lot of failed decision-making. They considered whether they could move him. But where? No reply. In this situation, they were friendless and paralyzed. There was nowhere else for Max Vandenberg to go. It was them. Hans and Rosa Huberman. Liesel had never seen them look at each other so much, or with such solemnity. It was they who took the food down and organized an empty paint can for Max's excrement. The contents would be disposed of by Hans, as prudently as possible. Rosa also took him some buckets of hot water to wash himself. The Jew was filthy. Outside, a mountain of cold November air was waiting at the front door each time Liesel left the house. Drizzle came down in spades. Dead leaves were slumped on the road. Soon enough, it was the book thief's turn to visit the basement. They made her. She walked tentatively down the steps, knowing that no words were required. The scuffing of her feet was enough to rouse him. In the middle of the basement, she stood and waited, feeling more like she was standing in the center of a great dusky field. The sun was setting behind a crop of harvested drop sheets. When Max came out, he was holding Mein Kampf. Upon his arrival, he'd offered it back to Hans Hubermann, but was told he could keep it. Naturally, Liesel, while holding the dinner, couldn't take her eyes off it. It was a book she had seen a few times at the BDM, but it hadn't been read or used directly in their activities. There were occasional references to its greatness, as well as promises that the opportunity to study it would come in later years, as they progressed into the more senior Hitler Youth Division. Max, following her attention, also examined the book. "Is?" she whispered. There was a queer strand in her voice, planed off and curly in her mouth. The Jew moved only his head a little closer. "Bitte? Excuse me?" She handed him the pea soup and returned upstairs, red, rushed, and foolish. "Is it a good book?" She practiced what she'd wanted to say in the washroom, in the small mirror. The smell of urine was still about her, as Max had just used the paint can before she'd come down. "So ein Gestank," she thought. "What a stink." No one's urine smells as good as your own. The days hobbled on. Each night, before the descent into sleep, she would hear Mama and Papa in the kitchen discussing what had been done, what they were doing now, and what needed to happen next. All the while, an image of Max hovered next to her. It was always the injured, thankful expression on his face, and the swamp-filled eyes. Only once was there an outburst in the kitchen. "Papa, I know." His voice was abrasive, but he brought it back to a muffled whisper in a hurry. "I have to keep going, though, at least a few times a week. I can't be here all the time. We need the money, and if I quit playing there, they'll get suspicious. They might wonder why I've stopped. I told them you were sick last week, but now we have to do everything like we always have." Therein lay the problem. Life had altered in the wildest possible way, but it was imperative that they act as if nothing at all had happened. Imagine smiling after a slap in the face. Then think of doing it 24 hours a day. That was the business of hiding a Jew. As days turned into weeks, there was now, if nothing else, a beleaguered acceptance of what had transpired. All the result of war, a promise keeper, and one piano accordion. Also, in the space of just over half a year, the Hubermans had lost a son and gained a replacement of epically dangerous proportions. What shocked Liesel most was the change in her mama. Whether it was the calculated way in which she divided the food, or the considerable muzzling of her notorious mouth, or even the gentler expression on her cardboard face, one thing was becoming clear. An attribute of Rosa Hubermann. She was a good woman for a crisis. Even when the arthritic Helena Schmidt cancelled the washing and ironing service a month after Max's debut on Himmel Street, she simply sat at the table and brought the bowl toward her. "Good soup tonight?" The soup was terrible. Every morning when Liesel left for school, or on the days she ventured out to play soccer or complete what was left of the washing round, Rosa would speak quietly to the girl. "And remember, Liesel," she would point to her mouth, and that was all. When Liesel nodded, she would say, "Good girl, Saumensch. Now get going." True to Papa's words, and even Mama's now, she was a good girl. She kept her mouth shut everywhere she went. The secret was buried deep. She town-walked with Rudy, as she always did, listening to his jabbering. Sometimes they compared notes from their Hitler Youth Divisions, Rudy mentioning for the first time a sadistic young leader named Franz Deutscher. If Rudy wasn't talking about Deutscher's intense ways, he was playing his usual broken record, providing renditions and recreations of the last goal he scored in the Himmel Street soccer stadium. "I know," Liesel would assure him. "I was there." "So what?"
So I saw it, Zaukel. How do I know that? For all I know, you were probably on the ground somewhere, licking up the mud I left behind when I scored.
Perhaps it was Rudy who kept us sane, with the stupidity of his talk, his lemon-soaked hair, and his cockiness. He seemed to resonate with a kind of confidence that life was still nothing but a joke, an endless succession of soccer goals, trickery, and a constant repertoire of meaningless chatter. Also, there was the mayor's wife, and reading in her husband's library. It was cold in there now, colder with every visit, but still Liesl could not stay away. She would choose a handful of books and read small segments of each until one afternoon she found one she could not put down. It was called The Whistler. She was originally drawn to it because of her sporadic sightings of the Whistler of Himmel Street, Pfiffikus. There was the memory of him bent over in his coat and his appearance at the bonfire on the Führer's birthday. The first event in the book was a murder, a stabbing, a Vienna street, not far from the Stephansdom, the cathedral in the main square. A small excerpt from The Whistler. She lay there, frightened, in a pool of blood, a strange tune singing in her ear. She recalled the knife, in and out, and a smile. As always, The Whistler had smiled as he ran away, into a dark and murderous night. Liesl was unsure whether it was the words or the open window that caused her to tremble. Every time she picked up or delivered from the mayor's house, she read 3 pages and shivered. But she could not last forever. Similarly, Max Vandenberg could not withstand the basement much longer. He didn't complain, he had no right, but he could slowly feel himself deteriorating in the cold. As it turned out, his rescue owed itself to some reading and writing, and a book called The Shoulder Shrug. "Liesl," said Hans one night, "come on." Since Max's arrival, there had been a considerable hiatus in the reading practice of Liesl and her papa. He clearly felt that now was a good time to resume. "Now come," he told her, "I don't want you slacking off. Go and get one of your books. How about The Shoulder Shrug?" The disturbing element in all of this was that when she came back, book in hand, Papa was motioning that she should follow him down to their old workroom, the basement.
"But Papa," she tried to tell him, "we can't."
"What? Is there a monster down there?"
It was early December, and the day had been icy. The basement became unfriendlier with each concrete step.
"It's too cold, Papa."
"That never bothered you before?"
"Yes, but it was never this cold."
When they made their way down, Papa whispered to Max, "Can we borrow the lamplight, please?" With trepidation, the sheets and cans moved, and the light was passed out, exchanging hands. Looking at the flame, Hans shook his head and followed it with some words.
"Es ist ja Wahnsinn, ne? This is crazy, no?"
Before the hand from within could reposition the sheets, he caught it.
"Bring yourself too, please, Max."
Slowly then the drop sheets were dragged aside, and the emaciated body and face of Max Vandenberg appeared. In the moist light, he stood with a magic discomfort. He shivered. Hans touched his arm to bring him closer.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph, you cannot stay down here. You'll freeze to death."
He turned.
"Liesl, fill up the tub, not too hot. Make it just like it is when it starts cooling down."
Liesl ran up.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph."
She heard it again when she reached the hallway. When he was in the pint-sized bath, Liesl listened at the washroom door, imagining the tepid water turning to steam as it warmed his iceberg body. Mama and Papa were at the climax of debate in the combined bedroom and living room, their quiet voices trapped inside the corridor wall.
"You'll die down there, I promise you." "But what if someone sees in?"
"No, no, he only comes up at night. In the day, we leave everything open, nothing to hide. And we use this room rather than the kitchen, best to keep away from the front door."
Silence. Then Mama.
"All right. Yes,
You're right.
If we gamble on a Jew, said Papa soon after, I would prefer to gamble on a live one. And from that moment, a new routine was born. Each night, the fire was lit in Mama and Papa's room, and Max would silently appear. He would sit in the corner, cramped and perplexed, most likely by the kindness of the people, the torment of survival, and overriding all of it, the brilliance of the warmth. With the curtains clamped tight, he would sleep on the floor with a cushion beneath his head as the fire slipped away and turned to ash. In the morning, he would return to the basement, a voiceless human, the Jewish rat, back to his hole. Christmas came and went with the smell of extra danger. As expected, Hans Jr. did not come home, both a blessing and an ominous disappointment. But Trudy arrived as usual, and fortunately, things went smoothly. The qualities of smoothness. Max remained in the basement. Trudy came and went without any suspicion. It was decided that Trudy, despite her mild demeanor, could not be trusted. We trust only the people we have to, Papa stated, and that is the three of us. There was extra food, and the apology to Max that this was not his religion, but a ritual nonetheless. He didn't complain. What grounds did he have? He explained that he was a Jew in upbringing, in blood, but also that Jewry was now more than ever a label, a ruinous piece of the dumbest luck around. It was then that he also took the opportunity to say he was sorry that the Huberman's son had not come home. In response, Papa told him that such things were out of their control. After all, he said, you should know it yourself. A young man is still a boy, and a boy sometimes has the right to be stubborn. They left it at that. For the first few weeks in front of the fire, Max remained wordless. Now that he was having a proper bath once a week, Liesel noticed that his hair was no longer a nest of twigs, but rather a collection of feathers flopping about on his head. Still shy of the stranger, she whispered it to her papa. His hair is like feathers. What? The fire had distorted the words. I said, she whispered again, leaning closer, his hair is like feathers. Hans Huberman looked across and nodded his agreement. I'm sure he was wishing to have eyes like the girl. They didn't realize that Max had heard everything. Occasionally, he brought the copy of Mein Kampf and read it next to the flames, seething at the content. The third time he brought it, Liesel finally found the courage to ask her question. Is it good? He looked up from the pages, forming his fingers into a fist and then flattening them back out. Sweeping away the anger, he smiled at her. He lifted the feathery fringe and dumped it toward his eyes. It's the best book ever. Looking at Papa, then back at the girl, it saved my life. The girl moved a little and crossed her legs. Quietly, she asked it. How? So began a kind of storytelling phase in the living room each night. It was spoken just loud enough to hear. The pieces of a Jewish fist-fighting puzzle were assembled before them all. Sometimes there was humor in Max Vandenberg's voice, though its physicality was like friction, like a stone being gently rubbed across a large rock. It was deep in places and scratched apart in others, sometimes breaking off altogether. It was deepest in regret, and broken off at the end of a joke or a statement of self-deprecation. Crucified Christ! Was the most common reaction to Max Vandenberg's stories, usually followed by a question. Questions like, how long did you stay in that room? Where is Walter Kugler now? Do you know what happened to your family? Where was the snorer traveling to? A 10-3 losing record, why would you keep fighting him? When Liesel looked back on the events of her life, those nights in the living room were some of the clearest memories she had. She could see the burning light on Max's eggshell face
and even taste the human flavor of his words. The course of his survival was related piece by piece, as if he were cutting each part out of him and presenting it on a plate. "I'm so selfish." When he said that, he used his forearm to shield his face. "Leaving people behind? Coming here? Putting all of you in danger?" He dropped everything out of him and started pleading with them. Sorrow and desolation were clouted across his face. "I'm sorry. Do you believe me? I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm..." His arm touched the fire, and he snapped it back. They all watched him, silent, until Papa stood and walked closer. He sat next to him. "Did you burn your elbow?" One evening, Hans, Max, and Liesel were sitting in front of the fire. Mama was in the kitchen. Max was reading Mein Kampf again. "You know something?" Hans said. He leaned toward the fire. "Liesel's actually a good little reader herself." Max lowered the book. "And she has more in common with you than you might think." Papa checked that Rosa wasn't coming. "She likes a good fist fight, too."
"Papa!"
Liesel, at the high end of 11, and still rake-skinny as she sat against the wall, was devastated.
"I've never been in a fight."
Papa laughed. He waved at her to keep her voice down, and tilted again, this time to the girl. "Well, what about the hiding you gave Ludwig Schmeichel, huh?"
"I never..."
She was caught. Further denial was useless.
"How did you find out about that?"
"I saw his papa at the Knoller."
Liesel held her face in her hands. Once uncovered again, she asked the pivotal question.
"Did you tell Mama?"
"Are you kidding?"
He winked at Max and whispered to the girl.
"You're still alive, aren't you?"
That night was also the first time Papa played his accordion at home for months. It lasted half an hour or so until he asked a question of Max.
"Did you learn?"
The face in the corner watched the flames.
"I did."
There was a considerable pause. "Until I was 9. At that age, my mother sold the music studio and stopped teaching. She kept only the one instrument, but gave up on me not long after I resisted the learning. I was foolish."
"No," Papa said. "You were a boy."
During the nights, both Liesel Memminger and Max Vandenberg would go about their other similarity. In their separate rooms, they would dream their nightmares and wake up, one with a scream in drowning sheets, the other with a gasp for air next to a smoking fire. Sometimes, when Liesel was reading with Papa close to 3 o'clock, they would both hear the waking moment of Max.
"He dreams like you," Papa would say.
And on one occasion, stirred by the sound of Max's anxiety, Liesel decided to get out of bed. From listening to his history, she had a good idea of what he saw in those dreams, if not the exact part of the story that paid him a visit each night. She made her way quietly down the hallway and into the living and bedroom.
"Max."
The whisper was soft, clouded in the throat of sleep. To begin with, there was no sound of reply, but he soon sat up and searched the darkness. With Papa still in her bedroom, Liesel sat on the other side of the fireplace from Max. Behind them, Mama loudly slept. She gave the snorer on the train a good run for her money. The fire was nothing now but a funeral of smoke, dead and dying simultaneously. On this particular morning, there were also voices.
The swapping of nightmares.
The girl.
"Tell me, what do you see when you dream like that?"
The Jew. "I see myself turning around and waving goodbye."
The girl.
"I also have nightmares."
The Jew. "What do you see?"
The girl.
"A train, and my dead brother."
The Jew.
"Your brother?"
The girl.
"He died when I moved here, on the way."
The girl and the Jew together. "Yeah. Yes." It would be nice to say that after this small breakthrough, Neither Liesl nor Max dreamed their bad visions again. It would be nice, but untrue. The nightmares arrived like they always did, much like the best player in the opposition when you've heard rumors that he might be injured or sick. But there he is, warming up with the rest of them, ready to take the field. Or like a timetabled train, arriving at a nightly platform, pulling the memories behind it on a rope. A lot of dragging, a lot of awkward bounces. The only thing that changed was that Liesl told her papa that she should be old enough now to cope on her own with the dreams. For a moment he looked a little hurt, but as always with papa, he gave the right thing to say his best shot. "Well, thank God," he halfway grinned. "At least now I can get some proper sleep. That chair was killing me." He put his arm around the girl, and they walked to the kitchen. As time progressed, a clear distinction developed between two very different worlds. The world inside 33 Himmel Street and the one that resided and turned outside it. The trick was to keep them apart. In the outside world, Liesl was learning to find some more of its uses. One afternoon, when she was walking home with an empty washing bag, she noticed a newspaper poking out of a garbage can, the weekly edition of the Malking Express. She lifted it out and took it home, presenting it to Max.
"I thought," she told him, "you might like to do the crossword to pass the time."
Max appreciated the gesture, and to justify her bringing it home, he read the paper from cover to cover and showed her the puzzle a few hours later, completed but for one word.
"Damn, that's 17 down," he said.
In February 1941, for her 12th birthday, Liesl received another used book, and she was grateful. It was called The Mud Men, and was about a very strange father and son. She hugged her mama and papa, while Max stood uncomfortably in the corner. "Alles Gute zum Geburtstag," he smiled weakly. "All the best for your birthday." His hands were in his pockets. "I didn't know, or else I could have given you something." A blatant lie. He had nothing to give except Mein Kampf, and there was no way he'd give such propaganda to a young German girl. That would be like the lamb handing a knife to the butcher. There was an uncomfortable silence. She had embraced Mama and Papa. Max looked so alone. Liesl swallowed. And she walked over and hugged him for the first time.
"Thanks, Max."
At first, he merely stood there, but as she held on to him, gradually his hands rose up and gently pressed into her shoulder blades. Only later would she find out about the helpless expression on Max Vandenberg's face. She would also discover that he resolved at that moment to give her something back. I often imagine him lying awake all that night, pondering what he could possibly offer. As it turned out, the gift was delivered on paper just over a week later. He would bring it to her in the early hours of morning, before retreating down the concrete steps to what he now liked to call home. Pages from the Basement. For a week, Liesl was kept from the basement at all cost. It was Mama and Papa who made sure to take down Max's food. "No, Saumensch," Mama told her each time she volunteered. There was always a new excuse.
"How about you do something useful in here for a change, like finish the ironing? You think carrying it around town is so special? Try ironing it."
"You can do all manner of underhanded nice things when you have a caustic reputation." It worked. During that week, Max had cut out a collection of pages from Mein Kampf and painted over them in white. He then hung them up with pegs on some string from one end of the basement to the other. When they were all dry, the hard part began. He was educated well enough to get by, but he was certainly no writer and no artist. Despite this, he formulated the words in his head till he could recount them without error. Only then, on the paper that had bubbled and humped under the stress of drying paint, did he begin to write the story. It was done with a small black paintbrush. The Standover Man. He calculated that he needed 13 pages, so he painted 40, expecting at least twice as many slip-ups as successes. There were practice versions on the pages of the Mulking Express, improving his basic, clumsy artwork to a level he could accept. As he worked, he heard the whispered words of Liesel Memminger.
"His hair," she told him, "is like feathers."
When he was finished, the smothered pages of Mein Kampf were filled with a girl whose brother climbed into her bed each night, a man who looked more like a bird, and how the pair of them had met inside the walls of 33 Himmel Street. A knife was used to pierce the pages, and they were bound with string. The result was a 13-page booklet that went like this. "All my life, I've been scared of men standing over me. I suppose my first standover man was my father, but he vanished before I could remember him. For some reason, when I was a boy, I liked to fight. A lot of the time, I lost. Another boy, sometimes with blood falling from his nose, would be standing over me. Many years later, I needed to hide. I tried not to sleep because I was afraid of who might be there when I woke up. But I was lucky. It was always my friend. When I was hiding, I dreamed of a certain man. The hardest was when I traveled to find him. Out of sheer luck and many footsteps, I made it. I slept there for a long time. 3 days, they told me. And what did I find when I woke up? Not a man, but someone else. A girl, standing over me. As time passed by, the girl and I realized we had things in common. But there is one strange thing. She says, I look like something else. Now I live in a basement. Bad dreams still live in my sleep. One night, after my usual nightmare, a shadow stood above me. She said, tell me what you dream of. So I did. Together, we looked through a crack in a door. Inside, we saw a family and a Führer, and we watched them disappear. In return, she explained what her own dreams were made of. Now, I think we are friends, this girl and me. On her birthday, it was she who gave a gift to me. It makes me understand that the best standover man I've ever known is not a man at all. In late February, when Liesel woke up in the early hours of morning, a figure made its way into her bedroom. Typical of Max, it was as close as possible to a noiseless shadow. Liesel, searching through the dark, could only vaguely sense the man coming toward her.
Hello?
There was no reply. There was nothing but the near silence of his feet as he came closer to the bed and placed the pages on the floor next to her socks. The pages crackled just slightly. One edge of them curled into the floor.
Hello?
This time there was a response. She couldn't tell exactly where the words came from. What mattered was that they reached her. They arrived and kneeled next to the bed. A late birthday gift. Look in the morning. Good night. For a while she drifted in and out of sleep, not sure anymore whether she dreamed of Max coming in. In the morning, when she woke and rolled over, she saw the pages sitting on the floor. She reached down and picked them up, listening to the paper as it rippled in her early morning hands. All my life, I've been scared of men standing over me. As she turned them, the pages were noisy, like static around the written story. 3 days, they told me. And what did I find when I woke up? There were the erased pages of Mein Kampf, gagging, suffocating under the paint as they turned. It makes me understand that the best standover man I've ever known. Liesel read and viewed Max Vandenberg's gift 3 times, noticing a different brush line or word with each one. When the third reading was finished, she climbed as quietly as she could from her bed and walked to Mama and Papa's room. The allocated space next to the fire was vacant. As she thought about it, she realized it was actually appropriate, or even better, perfect, to thank him where the pages were made. She walked down the basement steps. No more than a few meters, it was a long walk to the drop sheets and the assortment of paint cans that shielded Max Vandenberg. She removed the sheets closest to the wall until there was a small corridor to look through. The first part of him she saw was his shoulder, and through the slender gap she slowly, painfully inched her hand in until it rested there. His clothing was cool. He did not wake. She could feel his breathing and his shoulder moving up and down ever so slightly. For a while she watched him. Then she sat and leaned back. Sleepy air seemed to have followed her. The scrawled words of practice stood magnificently on the wall by the stairs, jagged and childlike and sweet. They looked on as both the hidden Jew and the girl slept, hand to shoulder. They breathed, German and Jewish lungs. Next to the wall, the standover man sat, numb and gratified, like a beautiful itch at Liesel Memminger's feet. Part 5. The Whistler. Featuring a floating book, the gamblers, a small ghost, two haircuts, Rudy's youth, losers and sketches, a whistler and some shoes, three acts of stupidity, and a frightened boy with frozen legs. The Floating Book, Part 1. A book floated down the Amper River. A boy jumped in, caught up to it, and held it in his right hand. He grinned. He stood waist-deep in the icy Decemberish water. "How about a kiss, thou mensch?" he said. The surrounding air was a lovely, gorgeous, nauseating cold, not to mention the concrete ache of the water, thickening from his toes to his hips. "How about a kiss? How about a kiss?" Poor Rudy. A small announcement about Rudy Steiner. He didn't deserve to die the way he did. In your visions, you see the sloppy edges of paper still stuck to his fingers. You see a shivering blonde fringe. Preemptively, you conclude, as I would, that Rudy died that very same day, of hypothermia. He did not. Recollections like those merely remind me that he was not deserving of the fate that met him a little under 2 years later. On many counts, taking a boy like Rudy was robbery. So much life, so much to live for. Yet somehow, I'm certain he would have loved to see the frightening rubble and the swelling of the sky on the night he passed away. He'd have cried and turned and smiled, if only he could have seen the book thief on her hands and knees next to his decimated body. He'd have been glad to witness her kissing his dusty, bomb-hit lips. Yes, I know it. In the darkness of my dark-beating heart, I know. He'd have loved it, all right. You see, even death has a heart. The Gamblers. A seven-sided die. Of course, I'm being rude. I'm spoiling the ending, not only of the entire book, but of this particular piece of it. I have given you two events in advance, because I don't have much interest in building mystery. Mystery bores me. It chores me. I know what happens, and so do you. It's the machinations that wheel us there that aggravate, perplex, interest, and astound me. There are many things to think of. There is much story. Certainly there's a book called The Whistler, which we really need to discuss, along with exactly how it came to be floating down the Amper River in the time leading up to Christmas 1941. We should deal with all of that first, don't you think? It's settled then. We will. It started with gambling. Roll a die by hiding a Jew, and this is how you live. This is how it looks. 1. The haircut. Mid-April 1941. life was at least starting to mimic normality with more force. Hans and Rosa Huberman were arguing in the living room, even if it was much quieter than it used to be.